All right, let's open up to Ephesians chapter 6. We left off yesterday talking about what I said is a theology of work. And if the word theology is throwing you off there at all I mean is a way to think biblically about work. That's what theology means, right? Is to try to think like God thinks about that thing. And I know theology means the study of God, but essentially that's what we mean when we use that word. And so I think what has happened when it comes to work is we've learned to think culturally about work instead of thinking biblically about work. And we need to make sure that our thought processes come from the Bible. I think we learn to think culturally about marriage. How many disparaging seemingly innocuous but really harmful things do we think and say about marriage that come from the culture and not from God's Word? when it comes to work, though, we were talking yesterday about filling our children's lives with entertainment. And that work becomes the momentary call away from entertainment, and the life of a child is mostly entertainment, and work is the momentary interruption, so that they have a picture in their minds. It's not just a picture in their minds; they have a whole life lived that way. I have a friend whose parents offered to take his children to Disney World. They wanted to take all their children to Disney World. And he said, no. And they said, and this is several years ago, right? This is before the most egregious offenses became known in the last couple of years. And he said, no. And they said, why not? And he said, I'd rather you take them on one of your camping trips in the Canadian wilderness. And they're like, no, we want to take them to Disney World. And he said, I'm not telling you I'd rather you not take them to Disney World. I'm telling you I won't let you take them to Disney World. Now, this became kind of a struggle because they couldn't understand. And again, it was before maybe even he recognized, and certainly before his parents recognized some of the... And let me just say, I know Disney's been an evil corporation for a long time, and some people are just now finding that out. But that aside, what he said was, I listen to what families say and what children say who have been to Disney World. And it forms a core memory for them. And it becomes, for them, one of the greatest moments in their lives. And I do not want that to be the greatest moment in my children's life. I do not want that to be the thing that they look at as the definition of joy. I'd rather it be that camping trip with their grandparents where there's no electricity in the Canadian wilderness. Tom Holly talks about going and preaching in the mountains of Chile. And there was a family who would walk to services through the mountain passes 2.5 hours or more, one way, getting to worship. And they would, of course, because it takes them so long to get there, they would stay all day and on into the night. And the father had to be at work the next day. But he would not leave until the party broke up, as it were. And then they would walk home. And sometimes the snow had begun to fall and the passes were more difficult. And so it might take 3, maybe even 4 hours getting back home, walking with his family, getting home with just enough time to get a couple of hours of sleep before he goes to work the next day. Years later, after he had passed away, his daughters were grown and had families of their own, and he was remembering with them fondly their father and that family, and he said, what were your greatest memories with him growing up? And they said, those walks home in the snow in the middle of the night, where he kept us cheered up by singing to us the songs and the hymns we had sung that day and reminding us of all the joys of the day, that we so quickly forgot because the elements made us forget. That was their greatest memory. And we give our kids Disney World. Woo, what a downgrade. I think that we need to try to build lives that make our children's memories about accomplishing things and not about being consumers. But all too often, our children, their great memories are about consuming things. To that end, we need to be more thoughtful and careful about preparing opportunities for our children to learn to work. We've talked about what that home looked like before the Industrial Revolution, going all the way back, really through all of human history. People didn't used to think, what kind of chores can I come up with my kids to do? What do you mean, come up with them to do? Get up and get to work. Go get the eggs. Go milk the cow. We got to get out in the field. It wasn't like they had to make things up. Now you want your kids to work. It's like, you want make your bed? Clean your room, yeah. Load the dishwasher. And we just run out real quick. And in fact, even those things, we find it more annoying to try to get them to do, and so we hardly even make them do that. We have a garden. Did you know we have a garden? Have I told you we have a garden. We have some chickens. I was telling a brother about our chickens, and he said, how much do you spend on chicken feed? I said, well, it's $20 for 50 pounds of chicken feed. And he said, well, how long does that go? And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, have you ever figured out the cost? I mean, are you saving any money? I said, I am certain I am not. I am losing a lot of money. But I'm not raising chickens. I'm raising a little boy. That's not my purpose. I think too often we think in terms of efficiency. That's what the world's taught us to think. It's what the Industrial Revolution has taught us to think. Everything is about efficiency. I know a man who I really appreciate, is a good man. He's an engineer, and he very much thinks in terms of efficiency. He has three sons. One of them has graduated high school. One of them is getting near graduating high school. One of them is close to entering into high school. He hires someone to cut his grass. And the reason he does that is because it's just more cost effective. The maintaining the equipment, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, I don't think you understand how much it's costing you. And I think that's the real thing, is that, you know, here's somebody that wonders how much it's costing me to raise chickens. And I think, I'm not just getting eggs, I'm getting work for my son to do, and my daughters to do, and for us as a family to do. Can you put a price on that? I'd pay a lot more than I'm paying for those chickens. So we have to make work back in, bring work back into our lives. And our grandparents are back there going, why? You know, somebody, I don't remember who told me that their grandparents, it's you, yeah. Why would you do that? Why would you go back? Like, we were so glad to get out of that. And I can understand that, why they were glad to get out of that. But I think that's the whole problem, is they had not calculated what else came along with that. We have gone through a series of generations where each generation has said, I don't want my children to have it as hard as I did. And what they haven't calculated is that them having it as hard as they did made them the people of high moral character, capable of hard work, capable of building things, and they are robbing their children of the things that made them who they are. And each generation adds to that. Each generation is saying, yeah, I don't want my kids to work as hard as I did, or be made to work as hard as I did. You know, I didn't have a choice. We just had to get up and get to work. Good. So we say, well, we do have a choice. Yeah, we do. We do. Technology has made it where we don't have to get up first thing in the morning and get to work. That's right. Will we choose to? I think we need to make that choice. I think we don't need to wait until circumstances push us into that, but we need to do it because it's good. It's noble. And it teaches us all sorts of lessons that God wants us to learn. And so why are we going back to that? Because we're starting to recognize that there was more back there than just the work. It was the things that came from it. In Ephesians chapter 6, as he talks about working, he says, slaves, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in the integrity of your heart as to Christ, not by way of eye service as men pleasers, but as slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, serving with goodwill as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good thing each one does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether slave or free. I want not only to bring work back into my life and make work the default of my life and rest the exception and occasion that helps me get back to work, but I want to work in such a way and talk about the work and educate my children about the work in such a way that they understand this principle. When somebody says, you know, for instance, nobody's going to see that. I want my son to hear, the Lord will. And that's who I'm working for. I don't care who sees it. That's the mentality we need to develop. Do you think that mentality is being developed? And don't you think that there used to be a sense of honor and dignity that went along with our work? That people felt that deeply across the board? And yes, there are exceptions to that, but we used to condemn that as a culture. Now we almost celebrate it. Find the shortcut. Find the easiest way. Our mind should be more elevated in our work. With regards to fathers and this 8-hour workday, this 9-hour, 10-hour, 12-hour workday, I think we need to be encouraging fathers to find their way home. Now, if that is simply get home as soon as you can after work, then that's a start. Fathers need to think in terms of, I've spent 8 hours away, and not think I have done 8 hours of my duty. No, you have been forced, and I believe that. I believe that the culture has forced men out of the homes, and I believe men are doing what is necessary, and I don't want to lay extra burdens on men, guilt trips and so forth on men for going out and providing for their families. But the mentality needs to be, I've been forced away from my most important work for the last 8 hours. And when I get home, it's not I need a break, it's I've got to make up for lost time. I've been gone all day. And I have been gone from the job that God gave me to do. And now it's time to get busy. I think what we think is, my wife's got that covered. That's not what Ephesians chapter 6 says. You, fathers, he says, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. I like that nurture and admonition language. I like that nurture especially language. That has to do with cultivation, cultivating that garden. I think we just expect those weeds are going to pull themselves. That garden is just going to flourish. It's going to be cultivated. They're going to pick up those things along the way. And maybe there was a time and place where the family that surrounded, the culture that surrounded, would pick up a lot of the pieces that fathers dropped. You know, that is one thing that we've lost in all of that is even if dad was away all day in the field, guess what? Grandpa was usually sitting at home telling stories to his grandchildren. That's gone. And so we've got to try to recognize that even if we can't get back there, we need to be compensating for what was lost. So the mentality of, I get home and boy, I've just got to decompress. Buddy, man up. Put your big boy pants on. Walk in that door and be a father and be a husband. And don't think that you're the only one who's tired. Everybody is. Having said that, we are a culture that that really presses the notion of security and certainty that really most people throughout history didn't enjoy. I said my own great-grandfather got away from the insecurity of raising a farm and went to work for the Ford Motor Company because that check was going to come in on time every week. And I look, I'm sympathetic to that. I don't want to just throw off on that. I understand. Running your own business is a risky venture. I was talking to a friend week before last, and he was telling me, he said, you know, I work for GE, just like my dad. And he said, I think it's killing me, just like it did my dad. They just run you in the ground. They use you up. There's no loyalty. And he said, I'm just so tired of it. And he said, but we've got about 5 acres, and it's sitting right on Highway 72. And I got a business plan. I want to open a dog kennel. And he said, you know, I've got the business model. My wife and my daughter are excited about it. It's something we could do together as a family. And he said, I just don't know. And I'll tell you, what do you think parents are saying in that moment? He works for GE. He's got a certain paycheck. He's got a certain insurance, a certain retirement. What do you think they're saying? Oh, don't walk away from it. I said, buddy, you get home as fast as you can. What can I do to help? You need an investor? You need somebody to come help you clear that land? I'm all in. I want fathers to be at home. And as a culture, we, especially Christians, need to be about encouraging that. I was talking to a young lady. I taught a college class over in Florence about 3.5 years ago on feminism. I was asked to come do that. I went through that, and this girl, she came up to me and said, you know, I agree with you. Like, obviously what you said is biblical. But she said, I am pursuing a career in marketing, and I kind of want to get into politics. And she said, do you think that's wrong? And I said, well, let's talk some more. I said, first of all, tell me what you think's right about it. What do you think's good about it? We had a pretty decent conversation. I don't know that we left in agreement. We had a pretty decent conversation. She came to our last gospel meeting. She's graduated now and has been in the workplace. She didn't get into politics, but just in the workplace for the last year and a half or so. And so she came, and she's about to get married. She's engaged, fixing to get married. And she said, I wanted to come to this meeting tonight because I wanted to tell you everything you said was right. She said, I hate the corporate workplace. It is not for me, and I think it's not for women. And right now, all I want to do is get married, be a good wife, and have his babies. And I said, God bless you. But I told her this, here's the dirty secret. It's not good for him either. It's a demoralizing place. And we have encouraged our sons, go get your degree, go out there, enter into that corporate rat race, and boy, just, you know, climb that ladder. Don't. Tell them to get off the ladder. Tell them to focus their attention elsewhere. We've been preaching, I think, some people have been preaching it's fine for women to be career-minded, but I think most people have been saying women shouldn't be career-minded, but it's okay if the men are. It's not okay. Men ought to be focusing on the family, and whatever career they have, it ought to be like almost, if that's all that's available, that ought to be some like necessary concession just so that they can provide the money for the real thing that is their focus, which is their families. That needs to be our mentality. We need to find ways to work with our families. Even if we can't just live at home, we need to find ways to to bring our families together in doing and accomplishing things. And we need to learn to sacrifice stuff for people instead of the other way around. People say, I don't know, we won't be able to maintain this lifestyle. Sacrifice the lifestyle, not the family. And begin to lay the groundwork so that even if today's generation can't get back to the ideal, maybe our children can get a little bit closer. Stop perpetuating where we are now. And stop acting like now, where we are now, is a good place. And try to lay groundwork and set up a scenario so that our sons and our daughters don't continue down the same foolish path we've been on. I get so sick of Christians and the way that they talk about college like it's this panacea. Like that is where success is. Listen, I'm not against, well, actually I am a little bit, but I don't think you're wrong to go to college. It's not the answer. And in fact, in a lot of ways, it is the problem. And so when people have been asking my daughter, where are you going to school? And she says, out in our field. She's done with school. She said, there is nothing that college is going to teach me that I cannot learn better by opening up a book of my own. And she's not wrong, not least of which this book right here. Nothing. And she can have it's not like, well, she'll scrape by. I'm going to tell you what, she'll have a happier life than a lot of people who think that that is the place where the answer is. Stop making people think that the world has what they need. And show them that the home and God's home is what has what they need. Okay. I'm going to go into the next lesson, and we don't have a lot of time, but I just want to, I know this is opening up a lot of, somebody said, don't open a can of worms, you can't put them all back. There's worms everywhere. I got it. I just want to open it up for some questions that maybe I can briefly give some sense of what I'm talking about here, because I know all of this is thinking maybe in a way that you didn't expect. When you thought building a godly home, maybe you thought, all right, got it, Gary Smalley books, right? That's obviously not what this is. So have you got some questions about like what this looks like? Oh, great. That was clearer than I thought. Colton.
So with preachers in particular, how is it that we can incorporate our children into that work? Because that is our, in a way, that's our garden, that's our field. And I know that you're saying, in addition to that, we need to be doing these other things as well. Yeah. But how do we incorporate them into that work so that they feel a part of what it is that you're building?
Yeah.
For the kingdom?
So one thing is, I have an office at the church building. And I appreciate that, and there's times where I go and I use that. I use it less. I want to be at home. I have lots of conversations about what I'm studying and what I'm working on for Sunday, and I get my family's feedback. Here's a point I'm thinking about making, and of course I've always done that with my wife, but this has made me more intentional about doing it with my kids. And especially when you have little kids that aren't you know, really small, but when they get to be enough that you're, you know, let's say 7, 8 years old, see if they understand what you're saying. That's a good barometer, right? I'm fixing to get up and explain this to a whole room of people, and guess what? Some of the people in the pew that are a lot older than 8 are thinking about at an 8-year-old level. So I think there's a lot of ways that we can do that. And I'll tell you this. I understand it's not always convenient, but I have tried to take my family wherever it's possible, wherever I go. People will ask me, are you bringing your family? God willing. If I'm in a gospel meeting, I want the whole family to come with me. Now, fostering has made that a little tricky, but the idea is I want them to be with me. I'm not looking forward to opportunities of being away from my family. And again, I think that's a whole other cultural thing that we're constantly talking about, like, you got to have breaks. I wonder what my great-grandparents would say, you know, if I told them that. Just thought experiment. Sometimes when I hear people say stuff in the modern context about the modern family, you know, somebody will take, you know, Proverbs, you know, that he who spareth the rod hateth his child, right? And then you get somebody, some modern thought leader, and he's like, you know, the rod is actually it's something that would be used as comfort, right? And it's a gentle sort of a picture. And I'm like, I just want to take that person by the hand, and if somehow we could just walk back in time like 600 years and just put them in front of somebody and go, okay, say that stupid thing again. I just want to see the look on this guy's face when you say that again. Right? It would just be so foreign to what these people think. And so I think we've got so much parenting advice and so much family advice, and we need to be comparing it to, you know, that. And they're all saying we've learned, right? I tell you what, you need to be real scared when they say that. And just bring it back and compare it to this. Yes, sir.
So the point you've been making is that industrialization and cooperation has taken men out of the home and taken women out of the mm-hmm. home and so forth. And now those jobs are being replaced by machines, as you made that point. And you look at, okay, here's where we're at. This is what machinery and corp. Now AI has come in.
Yeah.
And it is so accessible now. Even I use it.
Right.
and it's now going to take the intellectual jobs.
Right.
What's it going to be in 10 years?
Yeah. Robot can't tend your garden for you.
So the point is we have escalated to this point, yeah, or degressed to this point.
Yeah.
What's going to happen now that AI is in the picture?
Yeah, and I think there's some toppling that's going to happen, and we're trying to build something stable that's lasting. Marshall.
I will say, this is, as you have said, either in these talks or in person, this is going to be a generational culture change, even in the church, because speaking to Colton's point about preachers, it's not only affecting culture change in your family, but it's that you may not be at the office for 8 hours whenever people are driving by.
Right.
And they're expecting, we're paying our preacher to come in and sit at the office for 8 hours. That's going to take some time to change some.
And Marshall and I have experienced that pressure, right? Is that people like to see your car up there at the office. I mean, that's actually been said.
Go park it.
Yeah, right. I'm going to go leave my car up there and say, Amy, come pick me up. But, yeah. But that is, it's the whole culture. Our churches are saturated with that mentality. You got to put in your 8 hours. And I want to tell them, I'd love to put in just 8 hours, but that's a whole other conversation. You know, so the mentality is, if you're not at the office, away from your home, you're not doing work. Do you see how just perverse that whole picture is? So so we want to get back to that. Now, yes?
How can the children of the home work to help reclaim some of that ground?
All right. Excellent question. I appreciate that. How can the children of the home help reclaim some of that ground? I have a lesson about grace and instruction. And usually when we think about God's grace, as I talked about a couple years ago, we think about it coming in our direction, right? It's His grace towards us. But we don't think about how we respond gracefully or graciously, right? So here you go. When your parents say, take out the trash, I want you to consider that they have had to even ask you as a failure. Why did they have to ask me? Because I wasn't paying attention to the needs of the home. I am making them demand of me what I ought to be giving freely. Usually when we get into talking about God's commands, right, and when somebody goes, but do I have to do that? We've already failed. If you're asking, do you have to do something that God has clearly said He wants you to do, we are in a place of failure to begin with. And most of the time with our children, and especially as they get to teen years, people are asking questions, how do I make my kids do this? We're already at a place of failure, right? Because what you haven't done is filled your children with a sense of duty and participation in the home. Oh, man, 25 minutes. Okay, so just real quickly. One of the things that we've lost, and this will go some to your question here, Crawford. One of the things that we've lost in that picture of the home is a picture of inheritance. All right. When you think of inheritance now, and maybe your own personal inheritance, your parents, what you will inherit, what does that typically look like? When your parents die, what happens? Yes, we take... That's right. We take all of their assets and we sell those. We pay off all their debts, and whatever's left, you get, you know, enough to go buy a Happy Meal. So that's what inheritance looks like now. It's a check that you get. In these kinds of homes, inheritance involved everything. It involved the household. It involved the trade that the household was involved in. It involved the land. It involved the knowledge that all of this came to the son who inherited what was left, right? So when the son then was working in the home, he was working to produce the inheritance. As he participated in the family, he was increasing what he himself would get. And so in a real sense, that made us participants in our inheritance. And so when God's word says that we have become partakers of an inheritance, we are, I think, you know, it talks about treasure stored up in heaven. We are participating in the inheritance that we will get. We've lost that sense, right? I want to recreate that sense with my children. I want my children to think we're trying to build something here. And it's not just physical. I understand that. In fact, the most important part's not physical. I want them to understand we're building a spiritual inheritance and that you are participating in creating that generational inheritance, that you are falling in a line of inheritance that is being passed down from one generation to another. Along those lines, I have a friend who has stopped celebrating Halloween. And it's Becca's brother. And we were talking about this the other day, and he said, what we've done is we've decided to start a Cloud of Witnesses Day. Now, the Catholics would have called this All Saints Day. And so that's when what you're supposed to do the night before Halloween is remember all the saints. And he says, well, what we're doing as a family is taking that concept and making it very personal. And what we do is we pull out pictures of saints who have passed on, who brought us to where we are today. And we tell our children about who they are. What is our spiritual heritage? How did we come to believe the things that we believe? Who taught us and who helped us along the way? And I thought about that. My son is, his middle name is Edward. That's after my grandfather. And recently he said, he was looking through one of our picture books and he says, is that Papa? I said, yeah, that's Papa. And he said, was his name Edward? I said, yeah, his name was Edward. Like me, like you. And he goes, he died, didn't he? I said, yeah, he died. And then he goes, was he your friend? Buddy. Killing me. Yes, he was my friend. The other day, he was talking about Jackie Richardson, who started the camp that we go to. And he just passed away right before camp started this summer. He said, I hate Mr. Jackie's not going to be at camp. And I said, me too. He said, he's dead, right? I said, he is. He said, but he's coming back, isn't he? And I said, he is. And Papa will too, won't he? I said, yeah, he will. I want to add to that list for him. I want to show him pictures of Bob Waldron. And I want him to know who that man is. And I want my children's children's children to know who those men are. And be able to say, that's how we got to where we are. Because these men and these women stood for something that lasted for generations. I think we need to reclaim that sort of thing and stop just getting caught up in our busy schedules and our rat race and our disconnectedness. Well, that comes to then our next point, our next lesson that I now have 20 minutes to talk about. And that is that we need to be thinking about how to reflect the glory of God in our homes. Y'all know y'all remember the show Cosmos on PBS, Carl Sagan? Y'all remember who that is? Ken? You're old enough. Yeah. Well, it's fine. It's probably best you didn't watch it. But anyway, we watched it in high school, right? They would put it on. And he started that. You know, the universe is all that was or will ever be, right? So that was his beginning line. Carl Sagan was an avowed atheist, right? And one of his taglines was that we are made of star stuff. And it was this like glorious thing he was saying, right? We're made of the stuff of the stars. And his idea was, here are the stars that to him are the most glorious thing he can think of. And we're part of that. Well, he is saying we're dust. And he's not wrong. But we are not just a part of that. That's not the most glorious thing we can think of. We're a part of the one who made the stars. That's a far more glorious vision. I believe, though, that he wasn't wrong, that what is the way our homes are ordered should reflect the glory of the universe, but it should also reflect the glory of the one who made the universe. In Ephesians chapter 3, and if you haven't gotten the idea yet, I think Ephesians makes a wonderful book for making this point. The beginning of the book is talking about God's household. And the second half of the book, we say, you know, we got this sort of theology at the beginning, and then we got practical application in the second half. The second half is talking about how to order our households like his, right? The glory of his household and the glory of our households, hopefully, in reflection of that. In Ephesians chapter 3 and in verse 14, it says, "For this reason I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth is named." Now, here's one of those places where a language connection doesn't come through in the English. It says, "I bow my knees before the pater," all right, or pater, all right. So that's the word for father, from whom every patria in heaven and on earth is named. People say we need to get rid of the patriarchy. Can I suggest to you that this verse right here says you don't have families without patriarchy? Without the pater, you don't have the patria. One comes from the other. The father is the source of the family. And in a very real sense, when God makes himself, when God calls himself the father, he is saying something about our homes, and our homes should reflect that back towards him. That is, that he is the source of that, that everything comes from and looks to him. And in our homes, I said yesterday, we are the first reflections of God that our children will ever see. And if that scares you, then maybe you're not ready to get married. Because that's the mantle you take up, is to be, well, you know, to be a little lighthearted, the way, as George Clooney said in O Brother, Where Art Thou, to be the paterfamilias. That's what you are. You're the guy. And I think so much in our society, it's like, man, we just put so much on parents, and we don't put near enough. We don't recognize near enough that they are standing in and pointing their children to who God is. Our example of how to lead is further exemplified and most viscerally exemplified in the life of Christ, of course. And that's what Ephesians chapter 5 tells us. That husbands ought to love their wives as Christ loved the church. And so what have we done with that? I believe that the phrase servant leadership can be a functionally useful phrase. But I think mostly that phrase has been used by the religious world to cut men's leadership off at the knees. I believe we should be servant leaders. But usually, when you've got that prosperity gospel guy up there saying, servant leadership, run. Right? That guy is not talking about Jesus' kind of leadership. They might go to John chapter 13, which certainly gives us that picture of servant leadership. You've got Jesus down on his knees with towel, washing the feet, doing this menial task of washing the feet. But I tell you what he never sets down is his authority. Even as he's there on his knees washing their feet, and there's Peter going, what are you doing? And Jesus says, I'm washing your feet. Peter says, not my feet. If you don't let me wash your feet, then what? You have no part of me. Now, does that sound like somebody who's just scraping and bowing before Peter? No, that sounds pretty authoritative. And Peter then, he's like, he's all in for the ceremony. He says, well, okay, if this is some ecclesiastical ceremony in which you are anointing us, then wash my whole body. And Jesus says, that's not what's happening here. I'm just washing your feet. Peter's like, I don't like that. And he says, what I'm doing now, you don't understand. But you will. You're not better than your master. So you get down on your knees. And here's what we do. We do get down on our knees and we do serve. And then what we do is we say to our children, you get right down here with me. Too often what turns into is, in the best case and in well-meaning cases, fathers and mothers, they do get down on their knees and they serve their children, but they don't call their children down there with them. They don't actually teach the lessons. They're not thinking fully through John 13. We want to be servants who teach our children to be servants, who teach them that they're not better than their masters. So Jesus does teach with that service and so forth, and with authority, and with certainty. Now, somebody says, I don't have all the answers. Let me just tell you, if you're thinking this week, you know, hey, look, he's got all the answers. I don't. I do see problems. I see the need for answers. I know I don't have them, but here's what I want my children to come away with, the certainty I want them to come with. I may not have all the answers, but I want them to know that I know where to get them. They're there. We'll go find them. And I believe as we look to God in our homes and we look to reflect God and we look to reflect the glory of Jesus, if we're careful and thoughtful, that we'll learn to do that well. What does it mean to submit like the church? We look to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3 starts out this way. In the same way, you wives. In what same way? Same way as what? Marshall knows. No, back up. Look up. In the previous context, what has he been talking about? Whose submission? Christ and suffering servants. Servants who are under bad masters. In the same way, you wives be subject to your own husbands. So that even if any of them are disobedient to the word. In other words, if they're the same as those masters, you do the same as those servants, and you submit. And he says, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. Well, we got a long road to hoe there, because wives are being told by culture and even by their fellow Christians that they don't have to put up with this. And Peter says, you do. Not only do you have to put up with it, but that's the best path for them to get to heaven. It's for you to learn to, as Sarah did, call him Lord. I understand that what we want is not brutish leadership. What's the best way for a wife to pull her husband away from brutish leadership? Submission like the church. That's what Peter seems to say, is honor him in a way that calls him to better service, that calls him to live up to Christ. Well, here we are trying to reflect these things, understand how our home and the things in our home are connected to eternal realities. What we're trying to build in our homes is shadows that faithfully point to the real thing. In the Old Testament, Jesus is depicted. We've talked about this week in various ways. Jesus is depicted all through the Old Testament. For the faithful Israelite, when Jesus arrived, what they should have seen and what Simeon did see was the culmination of everything they had been seeing, the fulfillment of everything that they had been living. It, you know, sometimes people go, it's almost like they look at the Jews and say, well, could you blame them? Yes, God did. You could blame them for not seeing it. So here they say, we are people of the law. And when the fulfillment of the law stands right in front of them, they don't recognize him. They even make him out to be a lawbreaker. How badly did they miss it? People sometimes, Gail brought this up, sometimes they say, how could it be? I'm married to this person and there's no marriage in heaven. I'll tell you one thing that I think about that. Just like they saw the law, when they saw the fulfillment, as much as they loved the law, that should have been an easy transition, because they saw this now as a mere shadow. When we get to heaven and we see that glorious marriage of Christ and His church, all of a sudden our marriage turns into a mere shadow. Now here's what I want to say about that. I don't want to live like our marriage is nothing here. No, I want it to be like the law, that the marriage is the most glorious institution that we can possibly have here, and that even that, as glorious and wonderful as it is, becomes a shadow in the presence of the marriage of the Lamb and His bride. But we want to be telling that story the whole time. That when we get there, it shouldn't look like something different. It should look like the thing we were working towards the whole time. It should feel pretty comfortable, like we're at home, right? Only better. Let me press this just a little bit further in a few minutes. We need to press this into our churches. To Emerson, to your question of building culture, that's where we need to be building Christian culture, is in our churches. Rick talked about this yesterday. Why do our churches not look more like God's household? Because our families don't look like God's households. Because why are we so cut off from each other in our churches? We're so cut off from each other in our homes. You know, it's not just that this is distracting us from each other in the church. This is distracting us from each other around the dinner table. And of course that carries out into the church. When we see the picture of the church in the New Testament that is depicted as the home, it is this open and welcoming and very involved picture. People say, why aren't we open with each other in the church? We're not open with each other in the home. Parents don't know what their kids are doing. They're behind that closed door for 12 hours a day and they're just, man, I hope things are okay. They're not. They're not okay. I can't just go barging in there. What are you talking about? I was 17. My mom took my door off its hinges. And I was like, Mom, it's my room. And she goes, that's what you thought. That's my room. I think we need to press for that in our homes, but then press for that in our churches. We need to be looking for those sojourners that we talked about in that first lesson, the oikos, the para-oikos, those who don't have a home. God promised them that they would when they came into the church. And He made that promise to be fulfilled through you and me. We are the ones getting in the way of what God said they could have. And we have too many. And what happens is when people really throw themselves into that, what do people usually say? Man, that's kind of weird. People think, my parents, I grew up, and I do not remember a time where somebody was not living in our home that was not related to us. It just always was. Somebody was always needing a place. I mean, I remember one time there was like a week where we didn't have somebody. We went to church that night and somebody had come down and was fixing to start going to school in our area. And he was a little skittish about some of the options for the dorms and so forth in downtown Birmingham. And Mom was like, we just had a room open up. And then he lived with us for the next 2 years. And it was just a constant flow of that. So that when we got our home, I got a call one day from Harold Carswell saying, hey, there's a young man coming down from Chicago fixing to go to school in Montgomery. Could you pick him up at the bus stop and take him over to the school? Went and picked him up at the bus stop, took him over to the school. We got there. The dorm room was Sodom and Gomorrah. And I could see the look on his face. I said, brother, you do not have to stay here. You come home with us. And he didn't know me. And I think he was a little bit scared, but he looked around. He goes, okay.
You've got to be better than this.
And he lived with us for the next 2 semesters. And people were like, you don't even know that guy. First of all, I know people who know him. Second of all, he's a Christian. And it ought to be that Christians... I think about that. A guy called me a few years ago coming into Athens. He had a job interview. He's from Texas. He didn't know me. He's just like looking up Churches of Christ on the internet. And he called me and he said, I've got this job interview. He said, I need a place to stay. Do you know somebody could put me up? And I'm like, well, we can. And I called. I called for references to make sure he was who he said he was. But I'm going to tell you what. A Christian ought not to be able to come into Athens, Alabama and not find a place to stay. Like, what a shame that would be. That's the way the church ought to be. We need to be pressing these principles, not just in our personal homes, but then pushing that out. We need to be the start of that culture. Finally, Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10. In Ephesians 6 and in verse 10, starts this way. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the might of His strength. When you're reading down through this and you get to the armor of God, do you think, here's another section? Certainly that's the way they've kind of bracketed it off. There's usually a title there, the armor of God. I think that this is not Paul switching subjects at the last moment. I think this is a continuation of what he's been saying. He's been saying, set your lives, set your homes, you set your households in order. And brethren, that is how you suit up, and that is how we go to war. I was in a meeting back in April in Ohio, and a young man that had only been Christian for a couple of years, he and his wife had me over for supper before church one night, and they had asked me to preach on a lot of cultural issues, on abortion, on transgender things and so forth. So, you know, a lot of chaotic things. And it's not my favorite thing to preach on, but I know it's necessary. And so he was just frightened. He said, what do we do? How do we live in this moment? How do we respond? How do we fight? He had two little boys sitting there at the table. I said, you put everything into this right here. You want to know how you go to war? Right in your home. You have some more of these little boys and girls, and you raise them up in a way that shows the world we have a better way and that we are pointing to something more glorious. They are headed down a dead end. And when they finally get there, if God gives them enough grace, maybe they'll look up and say, is there another path? And we'll be over here saying, yes, with a smile on our faces, unlike the misery that the world's headed down. In Jeremiah chapter 29, and this is where we'll close. With everybody's favorite verse, Jeremiah 29:11, which applies to you specifically, right? I know the plans I have for you, declares Yahweh. Plans for peace and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. Back up to verse 5. Here it is. They're exiles from Jerusalem to Babylon. And here's his message. Build houses. Live in them. Plant gardens. Eat their fruit. Take wives. Become the fathers of sons and daughters, and take wives for your sons, and give your daughters to husbands, so that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there, and do not decrease. Seek the peace of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to Yahweh on its behalf, for in its peace you will have peace. And in that context, he says in verse 10, when 70 years have been fulfilled for Babylon, I will visit you and establish my good word to you, and I will return you to this place. What place? The promised land. For I know the plans I have for you, declares Yahweh. Plans for peace and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. And then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. I will be found by you, declares Yahweh. And I will return your fortunes and will gather you from all the nations, from all the places where I have banished you, declares Yahweh. And I will cause you to return to the place from where I sent you into exile, because you have said, Yahweh has raised up prophets for us in Babylon. For thus says Yahweh concerning the king who sits on the throne of David and concerning all the peoples who live in this city, your brothers who did not go with you into exile, thus says Yahweh of hosts, behold, I am sending upon them the sword, famine, and pestilence, and I will make them like split open figs that cannot be eaten due to rottenness. I will pursue them with a sword and with famine and with pestilence. I will give them to be a terror to all the kingdoms of the earth, to be a curse and an object of horror and of hissing and of reproach among the nations where I have banished them, because they have not listened to my words, which I sent to them by my slaves the prophets, rising up early and sending, but you did not listen. Therefore, hear the word of Yahweh, all you exiles whom I have sent away from Jerusalem to Babylon. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, concerning Ahab, the son of Kaliah, concerning Zedekiah, the son of Maaseiah, who are prophesying to you falsely in my name, behold, I will give them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and he will strike them before your eyes. Because of them, a curse will be used by all the exiles from Judah who are in Babylon, saying, may Yahweh make you like Zedekiah and like Ahab, and whom the king of Babylon roasted in the fire, because they have acted with wicked foolishness in Israel, and have committed adultery with their neighbors' wives, and have spoken words in my name falsely, which I did not command them. And I am he who knows and am a witness, declares Yahweh. What he's saying is, in all of this, I am going to make it really hard because people have not listened to me. That's where we live, in a place where people have not listened to God. And if you think God doesn't still act in this way to people who don't listen to him, then you have not read your Bibles very well. We're in exile. We're in Babylon. And we're in Babylon for a while. Who knows? What do we do? Plant your garden. Go build your house. Go get married. Go make some babies. Go find wives and husbands for them and tell them to make babies. And I don't think he's just saying, hey, get comfortable and build a life that's disconnected from me. He says, increase, do not decrease. Get busy. Live a life, build a life that says we have hope for something better. Don't live like people who have no hope. Live like people who are certain there are better things to come, and our lives, our very lives, point to those things. I think that what people think this means is, I can just go over here and do all of this, and then one day the Lord will come home and I'll turn loose of that. I want to be doing the kinds of things that I can do while looking up continually. Ready for that day. Building and involving myself and throwing myself. I think sometimes people think we just got to be so distant from this world. Throwing myself into this world in such a way that I'm not, when the Lord comes, I don't have to do a 180 to see Him. I'm looking in His direction already. And when He comes, it's what I've told people when I teach Jeremiah. The idea is get your hands down in the dirt, and as soon as He calls, you come running. Because you're ready. You're ready for the call. I hope we can connect those thoughts. That's the idea here, that we're connecting all of those thoughts about home and about what the Christian has to look forward to. As I said before, this is how we go to war. Brethren, suit up. Appreciate your time.